Oh, mercy.
Oh, what am I? Good morning. We'll begin with the minutes to approve. We'll begin with the approval of the minutes. I believe I talked with Representative Mahoney earlier, and he has thoroughly reviewed the minutes. And Representative Mahoney, you read the minutes and said they were good?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes from March 28th. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes. Good morning, Representative Gunther. Welcome to your committee. Oh, okay. So I should talk slower?
For 15 years. Is that how long you've been in existence?
Good morning, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I will move House File 3396 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And House File 1396 is a project that's been long in coming. For 15 years, the deaf and hard of hearing have not had an increase. They've been in existence for 20. And I think it's time that we provide a staff for that organization, and so they can serve more people and find those people that do need help that have hearing problems and hearing impairments. And with that, I'd like to turn this testimony over to Mary.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
I waited for my voice this morning, so I wrote that. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Elise Knopf, and I am the chair-elect for the Minnesota Commission Serving People Who Are Deaf and Hard of Hearing. It's also called MCDHH, and I will refer to this commission as the commission from here on out this morning. We are a priority of the state. We are the principal agency in the state of Minnesota to advocate on behalf of deaf and hard of hearing, deafblind individuals in the state, working to make sure that those people do have equal access to services and programs and opportunities available as others do in the state of Minnesota. We have we were founded in 1985 and created by members of the deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind communities. We are a 15-member governor-appointed commission, and we have 8 regional advisory members as well as 7 members at large. And we represent the entire state of Minnesota. And those state agencies in Minnesota as well, we look at bills. We are throughout bills throughout the state, and we really go through those bills and how they impact deaf and hard of hearing, deafblind people here in Minnesota. The commission has 1 staff person. If you can see on the map, we have 8 regions throughout the state of Minnesota, and we pick 1 member from each region. 1 duty is advocating for equal access to services and programs and opportunities here in Minnesota. For example, we advocate with the Supreme Court to hire certified legal interpreters for the court systems. The commission receives over 30 complaints, have received 30 complaints from people who are having problems with getting qualified interpreters in the court system. As a result from that, we have a court settlement that includes several things. Training for judges and court staff, and also an agreement to hire a certified legal interpreter if the need arises, and also a complaint system has been set up. Duty number 2 is to advise the governor and legislature and state agencies on the development of policies and programs and services, as well as using appropriate federal and state dollars. If you can see in the PowerPoint, there's a list of many examples, and I just wanted to pick out one because I know in the test of time for this morning. For example, we do have, the Department of Health has a newborn infant hearing screening program that provides with the Department on barriers regarding volunteer screening for hospitals here in Minnesota, and that's just one example. Duty number 4 and 6 is to provide the governor and legislature and state agencies with to advise them on deaf and hard of hearing issues, as well as also to provide legislation designing to improve the economic and social well-being and conditions for deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing people in Minnesota. For example, we have an interpreter law in Minnesota that's been established to have a minimum standards and certification for all interpreters that are in the classroom here in Minnesota. Before, we only had 5 certified interpreters that worked throughout the state in the educational system, and now we have over 300. So that was a really good for children here in Minnesota. Just one moment, please. Okay, duty 10 is coordinating efforts with other state and local agencies. For example, the groups that are listed here that we work with, they are all over the state of Minnesota. That includes the Minnesota Academics of Audiologists, Black Deaf Advocates, Department of Education, DEED, and here's just a list of other agencies that we work with. The commission right now has $95,000 for their budget, and that comes from the Department of Human Services, DHS. And that money, $95,000, has been there for 15 years. We've never had an increase in the commission, and there's costs that include just for one staff person. That $95,000 also pays for interpreters and captionings for 4 meetings that we are holding every year, and mileage for staff that are coming in from Greater Minnesota, as well as every year we need to fund transportation for the Department of Human Services. We also get funding from the Department of Human Services in up to $12,000. So we have costs that are exceeding our budget. And the budget for other Minnesota commissions that are listed up here. Here's a graph of the other minority councils here in Minnesota. So the commission, we represent 425,000 people in Minnesota with a hearing loss. So we have one of the smallest budgets. We also propose to use, if we do get this $175,000 that is coming from the TAM fund, the Telecommunications Access Fund. Arizona, for example, they do fund their commission with this same type of funding. Our commission has been advocating over the last few years, and that since it's implemented, it helped it also establish the TAM Fund back in 1985. And that funding was created to make sure that we have access for deaf and hard of hearing, deafblind people, and we would like that to continue. And so the TAM Fund has been ongoing, and we would also work to make sure that that does continue for the future. An increase of funding would give us an increase in accountability. Every year, millions of dollars that are spent on education and employment, and right now there's really nothing to track the impact on deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind people in Minnesota. We would like to track those dollars and see, making sure that they're spent and they impact the community appropriately. And also hope that the improved outcomes would result in a better access. And also an increase in constituent citizen involvement as well. And now I would like to turn it over to J.P. Wilson. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Okay. J.P. Wilson. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, my name is J.P. Wilson, and I'm 14-year-old, and I go to 8th grade in the Becker Middle School, and I hope to be in the first step to understand from the United States one day. And I'm here to speak in support of the funding on the MCDHH. Through my own experience in the program, I have learned more about the political process, and I have anointed to react the debt committee. We can find a solution for our own problems and barriers. We advocate for the solution to become a laws, program rules and enforcement of existing laws. And the last 3 years, we had training and rallies, but provided by the commission. They teach us how to meet with the legislators and how to advocate for our own issues. And last year, and this year, we had a activity rating yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 on how much power you think you have. I went straight to the top of the line. I'm a 10. I have a ton of power, and I do use it. Last year, I testified on an acoustic bill that passed last year, and is now in effect. Millions of state dollars for youth on classrooms that were even too noisy for normal kids' ears. Everybody was sitting in the back in the room. And I do have personal experience related to that issue. And reading scores were 6 months to 2 years below normal in that study. Studied this July, classrooms, all new classrooms must follow guidelines provided by an AISI. That is an example of what MCDHH does. It brings together deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people, and they bring them together and bring the issues to us, and then we learn about them, and we bring them to you as your constituents. Thank you for your time. We needed the commission, and we needed to be able to continue in work. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Hector Bruhl, B-R-U-A-L. I'm with the Minnesota Association for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Citizens. I'd like to talk, but I'm wondering if I could please stand instead of sit because I'm using my language and I believe this table actually blocks my signing. Good morning, Chair, Mr. Chair, and all members. MADC is the Minnesota Association of Deaf Citizens. We've been here in Minnesota for over 100 years, fighting and advocating for the rights of deaf citizens from year to year. Now, before I start, and I'd like to give you history. MCDHH, Minnesota Commission for Deaf and Hard of Hearing, was advocated by MADC. We are advocating for access for deaf citizens to communication in times of emergencies like hurricanes, floods, and so forth. Up until this point, there has been barriers that we have experienced, and we've always felt as second-class citizens because the information has come to us last. You, as a majority people, meaning your hearing, compared to us and deaf and hard of hearing individuals even here in the room, we, for example, when we're in our cars, and when you have speakers on in your car, you can't hear you can't necessarily hear what's going on. But we do we use our eyes to communicate. At Gallaudet College, there are four generations of deaf individuals who say being deaf is a full-time job. I am from a hearing family, and I didn't understand what that meant at first. But being from third and fourth generation of deaf individuals, advocating for the rights and so forth, at the same time, we have concerns here about hurricanes and other natural disasters. Like in Louisiana, in New Orleans, when Hurricane Katrina hit, we had several challenges that we experienced there. For 3 days, deaf and hard of hearing individuals there were in a panic. Some needed help. if they had problem, the communication barrier was clearly there. Now, regarding here in Minnesota, the government, we as citizens, deaf and hard of hearing citizens, we want to see that the government is providing adequate security for people in the deaf and hard of hearing community to meet our needs of equal access to communication. We feel that we need a safe place to live. Now, as you can see, the chair mentioned about 40 different organizations and as you, that serve deaf and hard of hearing. And they vary. But only MCDHH can work by putting all these 40 different organizations in the loop because of, and the common thread is hearing loss. We've known this organization for many years. Now, regarding the budget itself, for more than 10 years, there has been absolutely no increase. With that one staff member, even though we've been very successful with her work, still, for the last several years, I was there and I've seen many challenges at the national and state level. For instance, the hurricane was one big example. Now, I don't know if you're aware that at MCDHH, the commission, we applied for grants hoping that we would get money to support our needs, but we got rejected twice. Now, the commission works very closely with deaf and hard of citizens, but they also work very closely with government officials like yourself. The commission acts as a go-between the deaf citizens of Minnesota and the commission. They provide us an alley of information. Before I close my comments, I'd like to say that I hope that we can give you more by you giving us. Previously, and let me just say, I'm going to ask the interpreter to please stop voicing at this point. Did you understand at all at that point what I was saying? I'm guessing not. We need our commission there. They open the communication for us. So that means that we will feel a safe place here in Minnesota if we know that we have your 100% support on House File 3396. Thank you. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Gunther, we have an author's amendment. Do you want to incorporate?
Mr. Frick, Mr. Chairman, I don't see what the number of it is.
I don't think there is one on it.
Okay. Let's all get our pens out and write A1.
All right, A1 it is.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment to House File 3396.
Representative Gunther moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes.
Thank you. As you can see, this lowered the amount that was originally in the bill to $175,000, and the TAM funds has got in excess of $3 million, and it is going up and not down. And we feel that this would be very sufficient to handle this cost to that fund. So with that, got another testifier here.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Diane Wanchoba, and I'm from Blaine, Minnesota.
My twin 8-year-old boys are severely hearing impaired. 3 years ago, I was so grateful to have benefited from the services of the Commission serving deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind people in Minnesota. The Commission connected me with other parents who have children who are also hearing impaired and educated us on the political system. With the Commission's help, we successfully lobbied for a hearing aid bill. Affordable hearing aids are the cornerstone of my boys' educational, social, emotional, and intellectual success. With their adequate hearing aids, they have gone from testing half their age cognitively to testing above their age. They are now mainstreamed in their neighborhood school versus attending a school especially for hearing impaired children, and their special education services have been reduced to 15 minutes a week versus 2 hours a day as when they were younger. I know such legislation has helped others as well. I have received numerous phone calls over the past 3 years from strangers thanking me for my work on the hearing aid bill. I always tell them to thank their legislators for passing the bill and to thank the commission serving deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind people for working towards effective solutions for Minnesota's hearing health. Over the years, I have been informed of other hearing-related issues that the Commission is working to solve. Whether it's the prevention or resolution to hearing loss, hearing health applies to all Minnesotans. As a parent with both hearing and hearing-impaired children, it seems to me that the Commission serving deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind people is the only place to find legislative assistance for hearing-related issues. The complexities of hearing health are numerous, and the consequences of compromised hearing are great. As baby boomers age, preventive solutions for hearing loss are imperative. Statistically, over half of people aged older than 75 will acquire a hearing loss. As newborn babies are more accurately diagnosed with a hearing loss, effective solutions to their individualized needs are imperative. And then finally, as technology improves and teens continue to destroy their hearing with headphones, educational guidance and solutions are essential for continued hearing health. I am eternally grateful to the legislators who voted for and passed the hearing aid bill. I'm equally as grateful to the commission for helping people to find solutions and legislative experience to help my boys. Staff and interpreters are needed to meet Minnesotans' needs. I ask that you support an increase to MCDHH to adequately support this important commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Before we take questions, we're on TV today. Do you think the boys want to come up and wave to the camera and be on television?
They're on TV today.
Come on. It's okay. We got time. Don't worry. See, the camera's right up there. You just want to wave to the camera and say hello?
All your friends have seen you.
Good job.
Yes.
All right. Sorry about that. Representative Sodich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now when you go home, you can actually download that off the Internet and watch yourselves on TV. Not that I've ever done that before.
Nothing to do with a theater major, no.
No.
You were cute.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but just a quick comment. The commission, I have no doubt of the effectiveness of the commission in just the last few days receiving numerous emails and phone calls from families telling their personal stories on the effect that the commission has had on their lives. Feels good at telling legislators such as myself your personal stories and getting the word out to the families you serve. You're doing a heck of a job for them in other respects as well, and for that alone, this is a no-brainer, I think, for us to do. So thank you for getting the word out to your folks to contact us so that we can hear the good stories that you provide.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for the author of the bill. I'm just trying to understand. It looks like the original bill had $538,500.
Correct.
And now it's being reduced to $175,000. Can you explain? I know you said there's another fund where is the money going to be made up? I assume the need has not diminished. These are based on actual need. So how is the money going to be made up?
Representative Gunter.
This change was not brought on by me, but...
This is Mary Hartney with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. That was for the biennium, and actually we are assuming that the $95,000 that we get with DHS will stay. We're not asking for all that we need. We're just asking for what we thought we could get.
Representative Clark.
Okay, I heard two things there. this was for the biennium, so since you didn't get it last biennium, it's reduced. But the second thing is the $95,000 you're talking about, is it a hope that you're going to, it's going to stay in place, or should we put something,
Mr. Ben Ash, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we've been getting that pretty steadily from DHS, and it is in the base, I believe, and so we're hopeful that, there's no guarantees, but we're hopeful that we'll get that. So we're assuming that we'll get the $95,000, in addition, we're hoping to get the funding from the TAM fund.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, and this is for the author, I guess, one way to move beyond hope to ensuring they get that $95,000, I guess, would be to include some language in here that ensures they do get that. If it's not real clear to the department just as an intention, then we can easily help them. And I don't know if that would be desirable or not.
If you'd like to make an amendment saying that the $95,000 does not come forth... this amount is increased by $95,000 out of the TAM fund.
Would that be a provision? With your approval, maybe we can ask the staff to give us that amendment.
Representative Clark, I'm being told by a little birdie in my ear that the there are no plans to cut those funds, and there's no legislation to do that. Is that you want to?
Well,
that's in the budget, so.
I guess I heard enough question about, hope rather than a clarity that, I'll leave it to the author, but it seems to me like and it doesn't have to be done right this moment, but if that language could be included, is this still going into the omnibus, will I take it right?
No, this is going into our omnibus.
Maybe we could check to see and then if it's appropriate, that kind of language.
If we find out there's anything to the contrary, we will address that in the conference committee.
Thank you.
You probably be on, who knows?
Any additional questions for Representative Gunther or the testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 3396 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Next, we have... Okay. Good morning, Representative Ruth.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 1831 to be laid over as possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Ruth moves House File 1831 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Please proceed.
Thank you. Well, this bill establishes the Small Business Growth Acceleration Plan. You've heard it before. We were here last year talking about it, and we're not able to receive funds, so we're back again because it's fun to be here, as we all know. But it's a program as part of the Minnesota Technology Incorporation. And the purpose of this program is to assist manufacturing companies. As we know, manufacturing companies are on the decline, and this program would help with the economic development and job retention in Minnesota. And I have with me some experts that can tell you more about the program. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Fletcher.
Representative Ruth, before we do that, is there an amendment you wanted to move?
There is an amendment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I would like to move that. It is the A1 amendment.
Representative Ruth moves the A1 amendment. To your amendment, Representative.
The amendment, if you look at page 1, line 19, talks about that it would employ people in companies 50 and under. We're changing that to 100 and under. And then on page 3, line 13, We would delete the $1 million in fiscal year 2006, and it would just remain with the $1 million for fiscal year 2007.
Any questions regarding the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment's adopted. The bill is now in the form you would like. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Ruth. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Wayne Plutcher, President and CEO of Minnesota Technology. Thank you for allowing me to talk with you a few minutes this morning about one of my passions, GAP, the Growth Acceleration Program for Small Manufacturing Businesses. But really, as Representative Bruce said, it's all about jobs and growth, and that's where the passion comes from. You all know that 90% of our manufacturing companies have less than 100 employees. Manufacturing is about 15% of our state's economy. Minnesota, and this is a good thing, has a higher dependence on manufacturing than an average U.S. state. By about 10 to 20%, depending on whether you talk about the number of companies, the payroll, the number of employees, or the output. Manufacturing is the engine for our state's economic growth. This bill allows for a partnership between the state and the manufacturing community. Through MTI, Minnesota Technology Incorporated, the only state economic development organization that addresses small manufacturers exclusively, the state can help them develop best practices, become more competitive, and grow. Services like business planning, strategic repositioning, new product identification, and commercialization, factory and office optimizations and upgrades are all available, and what we at MTI do best, as confirmed by our customers. There is another aspect here that is very, very important. It is true that small manufacturing companies need our help in this partnership for growth. It is true that manufacturing is the engine that makes the state's economy go. It is true that by supporting the proposal and funding the partnership, this will help companies, it will help their communities, and it will help the state of Minnesota. But there's something else, too. An investment here is a way to leverage federal dollars that come to Minnesota and Minnesota Technology via the cooperative agreement called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, MEP. This is a cost-share agreement that was set up to be a federal and state partnership in manufacturing, specifically. You should know that our governor supports MEP, our U.S. senators support MEP, the majority of our U.S. representatives support MEP, and most states provide direct support to organizations like ours to support their MEPs. Funding our Small Manufacturing Business Growth Acceleration Program is also an excellent way to leverage these federal dollars and provide the expected direct support to help small manufacturing companies. It's all about jobs and growth and the engine that makes our economy grow. Please support GAP and help rev up that engine. Thank you very much. I would like to pass this over to Ms. Kim Roden, Vice President of Public Affairs and Customer Service at Time Warner Cable and Chair of the Board for Minnesota Technology. Kim?
Good morning.
Thank
Welcome
you, Wayne. Some of us do call Wayne Dr. Plutcher. He's a modest man, but we're very lucky to have him as our president and CEO. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm, as Wayne said, I'm chair of the board for Minnesota Technology. I also serve as vice president for Time Warner Cable here in Minnesota. I'm also an elected official in the city of Victoria, where I serve on the city council. And since 2001, it's been my pleasure to serve on the Minnesota Technology Board of Directors. And since July of 2004, I have served as the chair of the board. I'm also here to ask for your support for the GAP program, the Growth Acceleration Program.
As Dr. Fletcher and Representative Ruth indicated, it's been almost a year ago today that we sat in front of you at this committee to testify about Minnesota Technology and the strong value that we believe this organization brings to Minnesota companies. And this year, it's my honor again to come before you to reinforce our continued support for MTI and the work that the staff offers to small manufacturing-related companies throughout the state. As you all know, there's a real appreciation for Minnesota Technology's history of service, particularly in greater Minnesota, where many companies haven't had the needed access to knowledge as well as the expertise to help them compete, advance, and to grow. As a statewide organization, Minnesota Technology has found the need for its services to be growing, yet access to reliable funding sources in which to help companies continues to be a challenge. Now more than ever, Minnesota companies need Minnesota Technology's unparalleled knowledge and expertise to help them compete globally and to innovate for future viability. Many of you have small manufacturing, technology, and manufacturing-related companies in your districts, and for a variety of reasons, they could benefit from the services, personnel, and expertise that MTI offers them. While there isn't time on the committee schedule today to have any of MTI client companies speak before you, we wanted to make sure that you knew how important those companies are and the support that we provide through Minnesota Technology is in your districts. We also believe they would have extolled the benefits that they've experienced from MTI had there been time for them to testify today. There are many more companies that may be ever so close to being in a position to better compete and grow, but they just need a small economic boost, as Wayne mentioned, to help them implement technology and business improvements. Our request before you today comprises what we call the GAP program, which you've heard, and it's a direct investment to qualified companies with less than 100 employees that proves such an incentive will help them implement technology and business improvements. MTI's president, Dr. Fletcher, and the MTI staff have implemented what was a prior request to the legislature to create fees for its services. We believe this structure is a worthwhile component within MTI, yet the GAP program would go directly to small Minnesota companies that will enable MTI to continue to deliver the necessary services to help them compete. We remain vigilant in serving our public mission of providing small companies with competitive advantages that contribute to the growth of Minnesota's economic vitality. We believe a small investment, such as the one we're discussing here today, will help further that mission and further Minnesota's relationship with its federal partners, as Wayne mentioned, leveraging those federal dollars. And most importantly, this investment will allow MTI to help businesses with innovation and growth that we believe will return tangible results for individual communities and the state's economy as a whole. Thank you very much for this opportunity to visit with you today, and we appreciate your consideration of our bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Ruth or the testifiers? Representative Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of the testifiers, on page 2, I just want to confirm line 14, it talks about 50% of the total cost of a project and must not, under any circumstance, exceed $25,000. And then you come down to per year, and you come down to line 18, it says $50,000 per year. Does that mean that somebody could have two projects in a year?
Yes.
And then 50, okay.
So that's exactly right.
Okay, and then my second question, Mr. Chair, to the testifiers is, could you explain how the federal government, you said that there's funds available there, how this makes a difference in accessing more funds?
Yes.
That's fair.
Go ahead, take this. Yes, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership is out of the Department of Commerce and through an organization within the department called the Institute for Science and Technology. And it is developed specifically to help small manufacturing companies, and they define small actually as smaller than 500 employees. We go a bit further and talk about 100 employees or smaller. It's a cooperative agreement and a cost share program. So what happens is that in spending $3 to be able to help small manufacturing companies, Minnesota Technology has access, if we follow all the rules and the regulations and do everything right, to have a return of $1 back from the Department of Commerce in this Manufacturing Extension Partnership. So it's $3 spent, $1 back. And it is expected by the federal government that this is a partnership program with all of the states. These Manufacturing Extension Partnership centers are in each state in the United States. And most of the states provide direct support to their Manufacturing Extension Partnership centers. What happens is that that expectation continues. And if it doesn't happen, then I believe the monies from the federal government are at risk. And therefore, this would be an indication that, yes, the state of Minnesota sees the importance of helping small manufacturing companies. They drive the economy of not only Minnesota, but the United States, and they are the ones that need to get from their high productivity levels, which they've demonstrated in the last 3 or 4 years, to now this growth aspect that we all expect to happen. They just need a little boost to make this happen.
Any further questions for Representative Clark?
You mentioned the federal government's definition of small business. I believe our Minnesota small business definition is 50. Maybe our staff can clarify that. Pardon me? Can we clarify what the Minnesota small business definition is? And it includes both a grocery receipts and a number of employees, and I thought it was 50.
I think it was 52.
So this is double the size of what Minnesota considers a small business. Is that correct? Do you know? I don't
know that there is a specific small business definition for the state.
You know what?
Maybe we can find out. I know there is
a
definition.
It's
in compliance also with the National Small Business Administration, I believe.
Yeah.
So this is double that, I believe, although I could be wrong. We'll find out.
For the federal government, small means less than 500 employees. Medium means less than 2,500 employees. We have found out that of the 7,500 manufacturing companies in Minnesota, 90% of those, almost 6,500, are 100 employees or smaller. And it was our intent to be able to address this large segment of the manufacturing community with this particular bill.
I can understand your goal. I just think it's a departure from what we usually describe as small business, and I just want to be clear about that. If we're doubling in this bill, how many other bills will we then go ahead and change that definition? It's in state law, I believe, and hopefully we'll find out. And if not, if I'm wrong, that's fine, but I think we shouldn't change that without being very conscious of it, because it does change the number of businesses that can be these things can apply to. Then I had another couple questions.
Representative Clark, I think we might have an answer for the question here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, in Chapter 645, which includes many definitions for the Minnesota statutes, one of the criteria listed under the definition for small business is actually that it has 20 or fewer full-time employees.
Okay.
Representative Clark.
Well, it's kind of a truth in advertising kind of thing here that, you know, you may be talking about federal government statutes, but our own statute has a different definition of small business. Maybe we should call this a medium-sized business or something. I don't know. I just would like you to think about that because, it's 100 people in a business is a pretty good-sized business in a lot of our small towns. And certainly in my district, if we have 100 people in a business, that's not even little anymore. That's a lot. So I just want to... I'll leave that. That's just a definitional thing, but it does actually impact how many people could be served. So, and I know your goal is to serve a lot of people. But I do want to ask a question. This is through Minnesota Technology, Inc., but then I see that there's no technology that can be applied for, no equipment, no computer hardware, nothing that, when I think of the Minnesota Technology Fund, I mean, basically what it looks like we're doing, if I'm right here, is we're paying for service from MTI to some businesses that would be applying for this and getting $1 back for every $3 spent, I guess, in terms of from federal government contribution. But is that right? There's no technology that's being passed on here. It's kind of out of surprise.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, committee members. Technology is available. Technology from both the educational institutions that we partner with, MinSCU, as well as University of Minnesota, technology from the national laboratories that are connected to the Department of Commerce and the federal government. That is available. And we also consider business best practices as technology in the whole sense of the definition. So businesses have access to technology if they need it. Sometimes people think of information technology as technology, but it goes much broader. It's materials, it's process technology, it's information technology, as well as business best practice technology.
Mr. Chairman,
no,
would software be available through this? I mean, I'm kind of wondering what's special about this going through NTI.
Process or hardware would not be part of this program. This is actually to look at what is needed from, in this case, a information technology perspective, and have that plan developed within the company for communications internally and externally, and then have those needs met by whatever products would be necessary.
Representative Sertich, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I might be able to help you out a bit just using an example from Hibbing. There's a business there that has worked with MTI in the past that doesn't need computers or software. They actually make all the toilets, basically, all the sensors on the toilets of a certain style that do the automated flushes in public bathrooms and business bathrooms and that sort of thing, which I thought was really cool. So they have the technology side down. What they needed help with is doing opening up new markets and finding out best practices, but then also figuring out how best they can utilize their current system of developing those sensors and that model. So they're already a high-tech company in that respect, but they needed to find new and different ways to utilize what they already had and move that forward. So, and I was, before I toured their plant, I was a bit confused as well on what technology meant within the title of this this initiative. But it was started when you were here with Governor Perpich, and I think the name of the company, I mean, the name of the 501c3 has stayed the same, but what they've done over the last 15 years or so has kind of changed and become more broad.
Mr. Chairman, maybe, I mean, you've dealt in this whole field too. I know maybe someone like you would provide the kind of service. It sounds like you need someone who pulls together marketing opportunities, and I presume it has, if it doesn't have software or hardware, I do find a little, I guess their goal is you would be, though, trying to serve companies like the one that Representative Sears talked about that have technology as part of their products. But is that right? I'm just trying to understand here how, if I were to tell a business in my community, you can apply for these funds, what you will get is X. You don't get any help paying for technology itself. If you need new equipment or computer hardware or whatever, or you can get an agency called MTI to help you find markets. Is that right?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about?
Could I explain that, Representative Clark? What most companies of this size need is help with their business planning or their strategic planning, identifying new products and new markets, and then the process by which to commercialize those. And then looking at specifically the sales and marketing plan to create that customer demand and that growth in their business. Over the past few years, we have helped all of these companies. We know them in Minnesota. We have helped them primarily at being more productive, being more efficient, doing cost reduction. I say that now they are ready to grow, and that's where they need this additional help to be able to do the business planning and the new product planning and the commercialization of those new products to be able to grow successfully.
Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we want to make sure that it's clear what the intention is here. And Representative Clark, here's an opportunity for jobs. I mean, this is what we're here, this is our committee spot job, and we have a lot of bills that we hear for ways how we can spend money. And there are a lot of great organizations out there and services where we want to spend money. But here's an example of where we can actually have some jobs, and we get some of the money back, not to mention how we can have people feel good about themselves when they have jobs. So I would hope that you would support it. It's helped many, and it's an opportunity to help others too, help our growth in Minnesota.
Representative Clark.
Actually, Representative, I agree with you totally about, you know, what the goal is. And in terms of jobs, I couldn't support that more. And I'm just wondering, do we have, does MTI report to us on the number of jobs created, the kinds of, the quality of the jobs? Are they under that reporting requirement in 116J, or what do we get? I presume, I think you are, but I'm not sure.
Yes, Representative Clark, that is part of the bill. It's the reporting back on progress, but what we try to do is estimate what's going to happen with the help that would be provided, and then we come back and judge our success at doing that. So there would be a report of that nature. What is required as part of the cooperative agreement with the Manufacturing Extension Partnership funds from the federal government is a reporting of this type. We have to look at sales generated. We have to look at money spent on capital expenditure. We have to look at the profits made by the company and number of new employees added. So we use metrics like that always in our daily work now, and we would continue to use those with reporting back on this bill.
Just a final point then. On the reporting, which is on page 3, I didn't see the any relationship to jobs, and maybe that would be you just said the number of new jobs created. Maybe that would be something we could add there or somehow make sure it gets into the report, because I don't see it there.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ruth. I think this is an interesting bill. Looks like a good bill. I have a couple of manufacturing technology type companies in my district, 3M and Kodak and Imation. And Kodak is actually really quite a small company, but has over $1 billion in revenue that it brings into the state. My question to you is, for the $1 million, how many grants do you think that that's going to produce? And then is the $1 million, we allocate that to you in 2007, is it all spent in 2007, or is there a certain time period?
Dr. Fletcher.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, we would expect that there would be hundreds of companies that would benefit. If you think about $5,000 to $10,000 per company to be able to do this kind of work, it would be in that range. You mentioned larger companies, which wouldn't have access to funds like this, but the partnership between large company and small company is very, very important in the state of Minnesota because we have such a large number of Fortune 500 and 100 companies. So part of this is actually to create new business for small companies so that they can be suppliers to the large companies. The more that we can get to help, the better for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Swalwick.
Mr. Chair, and right, a lot of the bigger companies do spin-off companies from the ones in my district. How long is this grant for, or when do you anticipate spending it down?
Yes, we thought 1 year.
The whole thing.
Yes. We do that kind of work on a continual basis, so we have several field representatives that have relationships with these companies in Minnesota. They know the companies. They work in Greater Minnesota and have knowledge of their needs and what has to be done. So we think we can work on that 100-plus company basis in a year's time frame.
Representative Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I want to share a story of a company in my area called Klaus Stamping, a manufacturing company, and they were losing jobs. They weren't able to compete against foreign markets because they were doing things cheaper. And they wouldn't have been able to apply for this because they had 200 workers. But what they did do is implement technology that we have in the United States that in four countries they did not have, using lasers to help in manufacturing. And as a result of that, they are now up to 300 employees and doing very, very well. And so it was a matter of making transitions using the technologies that we have here to actually be more competitive worldwide. And so manufacturers have got to do things like this, and if we can make a difference for these smaller companies, I sure hope we can. I don't know why I didn't co-author this. I want to be on this bill.
Representative Sturge.
A bit of history about this. The state of Minnesota used to do this quite regularly. Like I said before, this was Governor Perpich's initiative. Before this, it was called the Rural Minnesota...
The Greater Minnesota Corporation.
Greater Minnesota Corporation. This actually started quite a bit ago and was cut in budgets before, and then the state totally severed ties with this organization, which was very unfortunate. A couple of years ago, about two budget cycles ago, 2002, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so it's great that we're getting back into the business of doing this, and Representative Ruth carrying a bill that Governor Perpich would be proud of. So,
Representative Clark.
So, Chairman, can I just check with the council? Is this is MTI covered under, or probably not, but maybe under 116J? If not, I'm thinking maybe a kind of a simple amendment, Representative Ruth, if you'd agree with it, since we both want to know that jobs are being created, is somehow just to tack it. I have some words, but is it under 116J?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'm just looking at 116J now, and the one thing that's jumping out is that business subsidies of less than $25,000 are not covered. So it sounds like most of these grants would be from less than $25,000 and therefore would not be covered by that particular reporting requirement.
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Representative Ruth if you would be amenable to just adding a line, a few words on line 11 on page 3.
Technology.
Following the actual financial impact of funds awarded during the past 24 years is what's there. And I would suggest something to the effect of including the number of new or retained jobs created. I think gentleman recommended new jobs, but I think it's also important when we retain jobs, so both are valuable. And that's a simple approach that I think might just do what you said you want to do anyway.
Mr. Chair and
Representative
Clark, as I understand from Mr. Pletcher, that would be a standard that we could do. I don't know if that would be necessary to put into the wording.
Chair.
All right. Well, then how would we
clarify?
How would you wish to have that written?
I can work with this staff right now.
If it is what they would be doing anyway. One moment.
Representative Clark, would it, since we're laying the bill over, we're not voting for it.
We can do it later. It's
okay.
Fine.
All right.
I just want to know if it was acceptable in terms of the sense of what we're trying to do. I'll work with the staff on that.
Thanks, Representative Clark. Any further questions for the testifier? Representative Westerberg, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We seem to be getting passed over here quite a bit. So we get no respect.
Your name was written in green, sorry.
But, Mr. Chair and members, I guess for our testifiers, my point is, or comments, I guess, would be that I certainly like this bill a lot, too. I think it's a great bill. But along with Representative Clark, I think it's important that we have, accountability, too. And one of the other things I think that maybe it was discussed, but recognizing that the testimony says that these businesses sometimes just need a boost, in order to really get going and be successful. Have you pursued the possibilities of revolving loan funds using the grant process, as something that could be replenished by the companies, especially, certain sizes, possibly 50 to 100 employees, that type of thing. Was that discussed at all?
Dr. Fletcher, Representative Ruth.
We did discuss that. We thought that this would be a test. We should go this direction at the beginning. Perhaps we'll learn some things, and I would like the opportunity to either come back and present the next year's proposal for this, either in the same context or modified as we see that the changes would have to be made to make it more effective.
Okay, thank you.
With that, Representative Ruth renews her motion to have House File 1831 laid over for possible inclusion in her omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Ruth.
As amended.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Norris. Good morning and welcome to our committee. Absolutely. The chair moves House File 3373 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I know you're a little pressed for time, so we're going to move as quickly as we can here to help you out a little bit. House File 3373 is addressing a couple of concerns, some unintended consequences. Several years ago, the legislature passed as part of a budget process the absentee for the absent day limitation for child care. And so there are some unexpected, unintended consequences. I have with me today Tammy Anderson, representing child care, and as director of Children's Corner in Fergus Falls. She'll list, I think, those unintended consequences that I talked about, and then we'll have the department here to talk about the solution that we found in this bill.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Tammy Anderson, and I'm the director of Children's Corner in Fergus Falls. We're a nonprofit child care center, only one in our whole entire county, and I'm happy to report it's our 35th anniversary year. So we've been there forever, and no, I didn't start it, so don't ask me that. Thank you for having me here, Mr. Chairperson, and all the committee members. And, you know, I don't have a problem with limiting the absent days for families who are on the program, but there was some unintended consequences as a result, and I kind of think of it as you don't know how things are going to work until you try things, and as a result of us test driving this thing, there's some little quirks along the road that we found, and so I'll just buzz through those quick as Representative Norris said we're a little pressed for time. The first issue I want to bring up is how counties are interpreting what an absent day is. And if you look in the dictionary, absent day means you're not there or you're not present. Well, that's part of one of the quirks we're working out, because the common definition is not that. If a child comes to my program and they're there at 8 o'clock and they got the stomach flu at 10 and they left, well, they were there, but the county will only either reimburse us 2 hours that day or make us use an absent day. So our recommendation is, you know, absent day is you're gone. And if you're there at all, then you're present. So we want to clarify the language of what absent day really means. And then my second point is, one of the other unintended consequences is it really discourages families from spending time with their children, because they're tacked on all these extra fees because they're not calling them a true absentee. Like the scenario that happened yesterday, I was talking about the boy who had the stomach flu. The parents are responsible to pay the rest of that day then if they don't want to use up their absent day. So they may have got tacked on an extra $20 for that day because their child got the stomach flu. And then you're penalizing the family again because they're low income, trying to work, trying to do these things, and then all of a sudden they get another bill because their child got the stomach flu. And $25 is pretty easy to use up when you have a child, if any of you recall how many times your child gets sick or different things that come up in a parent's life. But it is disheartening when a parent maybe gets called off work early. They usually work till 5, but they get there at maybe 3 o'clock, and they choose to just keep the child there till 5 because they know they're going to get hit with another bill. And so instead of spending time with their child, they'll just choose to leave them there, which is, I think, is a sad consequence of not encouraging families to spend time with their kids. The third point I want to make is who's responsible for tracking the absent days. It's another little glitch that came up. It's fine if every child started in a program January 1st, because they all start over. But what if I get somebody July 1st? How do I know how many absent days they had before I got them? Whose responsibility is it to track that? And our proposal is that, of course, the county would be responsible for doing that because they have all the information, and they need to notify us and also the parents, so then we can sit down with the parent and really give them a true cost of what it's going to cost them for us to give care to their child. So
because a lot of times we won't know for 6 weeks to 2 months after we've already given care if there's going to be an absent day or not, because, you know, we give care and then we don't get our check for, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks after the fact, and we'd hate to have to all of a sudden go back 2 months later to a parent and say, oh, I guess you ran out, so here's another bill. We want to be up front with the parents and say, this is what you're going to be responsible for. And the fourth point seems kind of minor, but to us it's not, because it's another expense added to parents. But they'll pay for certain holidays, your federal and state holidays. But say if Christmas lands on a Sunday, a lot of programs will designate Monday as a reserved holiday. They don't observe that for child care providers as an actual absent day. So we would like that to be counted as an absent day. Otherwise, say if we're closed on a Monday to reserve Christmas, which landed on a weekend, then again, that parent gets tacked on $30 more for that day because the county won't count that as an absent day. So hopefully that makes sense. And then my fifth point is the reinstating of the half-day rate for school age. And that is my most exciting piece that I really hope you really take a look at. And in our program, we had a ton of children. Just the parents said, you know, we're not doing this anymore. They're just going to stay home. They're 8 or 9. They'll just make it work. And that's really a scary thing to think about, kids that young staying home, because the cost factor really went up for them. And most programs don't charge hourly. There's very few that do. We charge a flat rate. And it doesn't matter if Johnny's there for an hour or 3 hours, our staff still have to be there no matter if they're there 15 minutes, whether they're there 6 hours. We still have to pay our staff. So all of our costs stay the same regardless if that child is there a short time or a long time. And so we really encourage you to reinstate that half-day rate for school-age kids. So I think I summed it all up, but I really appreciate you giving me time to lay out all those points. Hopefully it all made sense. I'll flag any questions. And I just want to stress, too, I think this wasn't an intended, let's pick on child care some more. This was just one of those fluky things, like the freeze of our child care rates, which really was a cut. It's another one of those weird things that happened along the path that I think will be an easy fix. It's not a big cost factor. It's kind of working out the fine-tuning details. So, thank you.
Any questions for Representative Nornes or the testifier? Representative Flower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Nornes and his daughter, if I may. Thank you for coming forward with this. And as you said, oftentimes we try to implement something and it doesn't work like we thought it would. Do you, and I'm on this bill, so I support it, but has there been an opinion by the department or the counties, or do you know what the level of support for these changes is?
If you may, I'd like to have the department come forward and just kind of go through. They've been, I think, very helpful in finding a solution, and I think if we could have a couple of minutes for them to
sure.
kind of walk through what we've done to address this, that'd be helpful.
That'd be great. Yes, sir. Before we
do have an amendment as well. You can take that whenever you'd like.
And
the amendment was brought by the department just prior to the hearing.
Representative Gunther moves the A1 amendment to the amendment. Representative Nornes, do you want to discuss it?
Again, this was brought to us by the department this morning to address, in one case, a date and then some additional language, so they can address that as well in their presentation.
Okay.
But it's technical, I guess.
Okay. Any questions for the testifier or for Representative Nornes on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment's adopted. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. My name is Cherie Patelnik. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And I need to start out first by saying that this is not in the governor's budget. So while we worked with the authors of this bill to come up with language that would operationalize the changes that are identified by the community and by some counties and as needed changes, it is not in the governor's budget. So that's our position on it. We have heard when the half-day rates were eliminated, we did hear a very quick and loud outcry from school-age providers at the point that they were eliminated. I think they were the most affected group with the half-day rates, and primarily because school-age care during the school year is generally charged session fees. And so you pay an amount of money, and then you go for whatever hours your child needs to go, but they can't fill that with another child. They have certain ratios they have to meet, and they charge session fees. So when it moved to an hourly rate and the payments were capped, we heard more from school-age providers than anything else. I think mostly because hourly isn't something the market charges when it comes to school-age care, and that was the big thing there. Some of the changes that are identified for, like, holiday pay are things that already are, counties are being given direction to implement them the way they are identified in statutes. You'll note there's no fiscal note for those particular provisions. We have had, this is a very complicated policy to implement, and it's also a policy that has not been supported by technology. If we remember in testimony last year, the counties and many of the testifiers agreed that it would be difficult to implement without technology. I think we're experiencing that. The changes that the department is proposing to the language that came in the first bill, the amendment that we just offered, is designed to make sure that the notification processes align with what we can do in an automated system. We are building the automated system to provide notification to families and parents about the number of absent days that are used and to track absent days. And that system, as you know, is intended to be implemented in January of 07. And so we want to make sure that the language in the bill aligns with what we can do with technology. And so we work with the office to make those changes. The other change that was offered by the department was an effective date of September 4th for the half-day rate changes for two reasons. One is that we have implemented a number of different rate protocols as a result of the legislative auditor's recommendations related to the rates analysis. They have never been applied to half-day rates because half-day rates were eliminated. We need some time to implement the new rate protocol along with the half-day change if that happens. We also believe that by implementing on September 4th, we shouldn't be negatively affecting anyone because the school-age session rates are generally based on school year times and school starts in September, and so we should have them in place in time to make it work for families needing school-age care during the school year.
Any further questions for the testifier or the witness? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to congratulate Ms. Anderson and other providers, frankly, who brought these concerns to us originally. I appreciate the fact that you're interested, as I am, in being sure that the taxpayer is being treated fairly and abuses are dealt with, even though they may not be common. The public confidence is really important, so thank you for that. And you're right, we learn from things. I want to confirm one thing. It's so general in here, but I'm not sure about the placement. But it reads to me as though one of the qualifiers is that this would be consistent with the practices that a child care provider has with their regular paying customers. Is that true across the board, Representative Onus or Anderson, whoever?
Representative Bradley, yes, you're correct. We still can never charge private pay families more than county. I mean, it still has to be the same.
You're okay. Correct. Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, I have one other question. This may be something that I can discuss afterward, but just at least bring it up. I was trying to read, I understand that particularly if a child comes from someplace else, you can be sort of caught with not realizing that the 25-day or the 10-day limits have been reached, and that's not the fault of the child care provider. However, it wasn't clear to me, because it calls for prior notification, that if the child is actually in the same provider and the provider themselves should know where the count is at that point, that we don't sort of pay for something because there might be a lag, and I don't know what our system for notification might be, but I can understand sort of a lag coming back from the department. So I don't think you intended that, but it looks like it could have that we might... We might have a few days lag because everything seems a contingent on prior notification. And in a case where it's a child that is always in that same place, you would know when you reached it. Can you give just a little insight, and if necessary, I can follow up later.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley. I think that was one of the department's concerns, too. It's impossible to give prior notification because by the time we know that the absence day has been used, it's no longer prior. And so the thing that we worked with the advocates on is a reasonable notification process. And that notification process would be that at the point that care is authorized for a family, both the family and the provider would be notified of the number of absent days used because it might be in the middle of the year or whatever. So you get your initial notification. And then every time a remittance is paid, the family and the provider would get notification as of that date of how many absent days have been used. So it would not be prior notification, but it would be ongoing notification so that people can work in a planful way. And there are a number of, many of our families have multiple providers, so it is an important thing to keep both the providers and the families aware of the number of absent days that have been used.
Well, Mr. Chair, I won't go any further, but the word prior notification is still in the language yet, so I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the A1 removed that, but I have not seen the A1.
Here, I can show it to you.
I don't think so.
Yes.
If the whole line is taken out, that's why I missed it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions for the testifiers, Representative me, I renew my motion to have House File 3373 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Nornes. Representative Surge.
We get credit for Amherst Bill yesterday.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'd like to move that House File 3476 for possible inclusion in the jobs omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Surge. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Come before you today with a bill with a group advocating change together that's been before this committee and body before in the past. Looking for a modest appropriation to help with training and employment training and empowerment training for some other individuals that have different barriers than the ones we've heard earlier today. And with that, I will hand it over to someone else who's very familiar to the committee, Mr. Cardenas, to continue the testimony.
Yeah.
Morning. Welcome to our committee.
Rick Cardenas, chair and other members of the committee. I'm with Advocating Change Together. I'm co-director, and as Representative Surge said, we've been in front of this committee many times over the years, and hopefully you would look at what we're trying to propose within this is to please do our workshop presentation, which is a multimedia, lecture, speaking, videos, and exercises within the workshop, and it's all in the purpose of developing people's confidence and willingness to take jobs in the community. We have we've done this for 10 years now, and at times the funding has come from the state. Two times we got some funding from the state, and most of the time we're picking up money that comes from foundations on particular grants for persons with developmental disabilities and other disabilities. And this is Manny Steinman, and I want him to read a short statement.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Manny H. Steinman.
Please proceed.
Okay, I got a little statement I'd like to read, but bear with me. I do have a small stuttering problem, so bear with me. You know, that's all I ask. I don't ask too much. The historic person was disability, mental, I can't even pronounce the word. The mental and mental health disabilities have been on the receiving end of changes. having a little control over what services we receive, what accumulated accommodations are made for us in our community. And the lack of opportunities able for persons with disabilities to have a community-based jobs. The Common Vision program contains many multiple media experience with which focus on what the possibility are within our work site setting today. We are giving experience and protection presentation to secret sections of the workshops for involvement self-advocacy. We are creating more opportunities for people to be involved in active changes together presentation to explain skills, knowledge, and confidence to do our presentations on their own for other self-advocacy groups. Ongoing.
So what we try to do is around the state, through the regions, we will provide that training. And what we're trying to do is train individuals with developmental and other mental health disabilities to do that to another group. And that's part of the condition. Coming to the workshop, they will obligate themselves to provide 3-4 more trainings to a number of other groups. And as the Developmental Disabilities Council has counted, there are now 51 organizations throughout the state that call themselves self-advocacy groups. And it's an important step on the way to any employment that individuals are looking for.
Any questions for Representative Sturridge for the testifiers? Representative?
Mr. Chairman, it's not so much a question, it's just to say I know you do really good work, and I thought your testimony was excellent.
I'm sorry about the stuttering this morning.
You know? We're very glad to be here. You're doing exactly what the organization exists to do, so I compliment you on that. And I just wanted to say that I just think you should feel really good about being here with us.
You should hear Representative Sturridge sometimes in the morning. Yes.
Can I just add? Sorry, give me that little fluggy talky frog in my throat. But it wasn't for my special teacher back at Emerson back in the 70s. If it wasn't for her to correct my speech problem, I wouldn't be able to speak today to any of you. Mm-hmm. And I'm real grateful that she spent Thursday evenings with me from nine at night until 11 at night just to get my speech problem corrected. And she said I did a remarkable job to do that. It was real hard. But I did the best I can, and that's what I'm at today.
Okay. Fantastic. With that, Representative Sturridge renews his motion to have House File 3476 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks.
Representative Dabney.
Karen? Oh, I'll move, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 3573.
Representative Clark moves House File 3573 for passage and referral to the Civil Law Committee.
Is that right?
Representative Dabney, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3573 to you this morning. I'm sure I don't need to tell members of this committee of the problems that communities around the state face with vacant boarded houses. We know that boarded housing breeds crime. We know that it provides a haven for drug use and a target of opportunity for gang activity. House File 3573 is an attempt to develop a new tool already in use in several other states to help communities work with those boarded vacant properties, bring them back on the market, inhabitable, and help to stabilize those communities. The bill adopts legislation that's already in place in Ohio and Illinois, allowing local governments along with nonprofits, including churches, to rehabilitate those vacant boarded properties and provide the community with the benefits of reduced crime and greater community stability. The short summary in your packet does a good job of summarizing this legislation. In many ways, this legislation builds conceptually on the Tenant Remedies Act, Minnesota Statutes 504B, that allows neighborhood housing organizations to be designated by the courts as the administrators of rundown inhabited rental housing. This proposal is narrowly crafted to focus on uninhabited nuisance properties. It provides a rich judicial process to protect and balance the rights and needs of both the absent owner and the community in question. The bill provides judicial oversight and reports by the community nonprofits on their progress in rehabbing the property and returning it to habitable form, making it available for housing, increasing the values of that property and surrounding properties, and reducing crime. With that, members and Mr. Chair, let me introduce my testifiers who can speak to the bill. First, Ms. Sherry Pugh, the Executive Director of the Northside Redevelopment Council.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Sherry Pugh. I'm the Executive Director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. We are a 35-year-old community development corporation founded after the rebellions that happened in 1968 on the north side of Minneapolis. I also serve as the chair of the Minneapolis Consortium of Community Developers and also on the National Board of the National Congress for Community Economic Development, in which the field represents over 3,000 CDCs nationally, developing and building communities. We are very excited about this bill for the North Side and also other nonprofits, and I think several of you may have gotten correspondence from colleagues of ours about this bill. Nuisance properties, those vacant properties where the owners take no interest in doing any renovation and making them viable properties in our neighborhoods, are a problem. Just two blocks from our office is a building, a wonderful unit that could be three housing units, which has sat vacant for 4 years. During that time, individuals have approached the owner and said, "Would you sell it?" The owner persistently does not want to sell, but maintains the building as vacant. He gladly pays the fine for boarding it, but won't fix it up. And at any day, I could take you there today, we could walk into this place, beer cans up to your knees, so you know that it is inhabited, not by legal residents, but by individuals who are doing negative activities. These are problems for our community because we've worked really hard in the last 12 years to change home ownership and to improve the affordable rental in our community. The example is that prior to 1990, the home ownership rates in the Near North and Willard Hay neighborhoods were under 25%. Today, in Near North, the home ownership rate is up to 30%, and in Willard Hay, the home ownership rate is up to 60%. Also, we had 200 vacant properties, and we had vacant lots. We've now dwindled that down to 6 vacant lots, and we've renovated lots of properties. But we still have individuals who, I guess, consider themselves investors. We consider them disinvestors who maintain properties that still cause problems as we're trying to assist families and build a community that has assets. So this bill would provide us the opportunity, not on a large-scale basis, but it does allow us to go and tackle some of these difficult properties in the community, to renovate them, to get them back into service, and make them viable assets in our community, and to also help alleviate the negative activities that occur around the neighbors, adjacent neighbors. We do feel that there could be some modifications to this, but we're not pressing for that. We would be glad to do the rental, but if there was an opportunity later to consider reducing the second year to 1 year on the time period after the nonprofit renovates, and to allow the opportunity to turn these units into ownership and not just rental, we would also like to see that happen with the bill. Again, this is an important bill to us. It is something that affects not only our core urban neighborhood, but also those rural communities. Our colleagues in rural communities talk about the vacant properties becoming the meth labs, which have become a huge problem in rural Minnesota. And so it is an issue that can be addressed statewide. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned nonprofits that rehab these properties. Can you give me examples of those? What kind of nonprofits are they? I think it's a great idea.
Oh, well, community development corporations have been in existence since about 1968. They were formed after the war on poverty.
So this is your neighborhood development?
We're a neighborhood development corporation. We buy homes. Last year, with the assistance of the city of Minneapolis, we purchased a home that had had a fire. It was a 1,200 square foot rambler that had the roof burnt out of it. We took that home, added a second floor, made it into an 1,800 square foot home, four bedrooms, two and a half baths, and we sold it to a new homeowner, first time homeowner, a woman who had four children, and so now she resides there.
Wonderful.
So we do many things like that, as well as we do affordable rental housing.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, if members are not familiar with community development corporations, they have maybe a three-pronged responsibility. One is working on housing issues in their defined area, their community. Secondly, they often engage with small business development, working with either existing small businesses as they develop and change, or helping entrepreneurs in the neighborhood or entrepreneurs from outside who are wanting to come into the neighborhood and establish businesses to find the appropriate settings and get engaged in private business activities. And lastly, they are the neighborhood, the community's voice on development issues. So they will work with outside developers, both private for-profit and non-profit, and be the interface between the community and the developers to help move development projects along in ways that work both for the developer and for the community. Next, I'd like to introduce Ms. Janet Beasley from the Kwanzaa Community Church. Ms. Beasley.
Good morning, Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. My name is Janet Beasley, and I represent Kwanzaa Community Presbyterian Church, and where I serve as the strategic plan coordinator and the business manager. We have approximately 125 families, three-fourths of which live in the 55411 and 55412 zip codes. The remainder live across the Twin Cities and in surrounding suburbs. The great majority of our church members struggle to live at or below the poverty federal poverty guidelines. First, there are two issues at stake in this bill. The large number of abandoned houses and houses of illegal activity in our part of the city are a clear and present danger to the families of North Minneapolis. Our children and our families are regularly exposed to drug activity, gunfire, prostitution, vandalism, and a variety of other crimes. The working poor of our area are in desperate need of decent and housing, safe and affordable rental housing, as well as home ownership. According to a poll released recently from the Northwest Area Foundation, affordable housing is one of the top three concerns of all citizens of Minnesota, along with good jobs and access to health care. Within our congregation, I can cite many examples of our working families having difficulty with housing. We have two single mothers that have dealt with sewage leaking in their ceilings and landlords who would not do any repairs. We have people who can't afford the homes they're living in and have to save and scrimp and do without transportation, and their children are unable to participate in a variety of activities based on the cost of the housing alone. Section 8 in Minneapolis has been closed for at least 2 years, and subsidized units are impossible to find. People of low and moderate incomes deserve affordable housing that is competently managed by nonprofit agencies who have demonstrated an investment in the community. Our church and many other faith-based secular organizations across the city have been working together for years to build the capacity to partner with each other to provide quality housing. We are poised to assist in the rebuilding of our city, and we ask that you seriously consider this bill. Thank you for...
Any questions for Representative Dabney or the testifiers? I'm Representative Dabney, just to clarify, this is only for homes that have been unoccupied in the last year, correct?
That's correct. These are two pieces, Mr. Chair, uninhabited and identified as nuisance properties.
It has to meet both criteria, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions for the representative?
Just a comment. This seems like another good tool in the toolbox of ways to try to help clean up some of the problems in our neighborhood. So hopefully it'll help.
And Representative Dabney, with that, Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File 3573 passed and referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. With that, unless Chairman Gunther, do you have any announcements? Or?
I can't think of any. We had any minutes to approve?
We already approved them.
Yeah, okay.
With that, the committee is in adjournment. Thank you.